For Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. This week, Arizona Public Media is presenting a series called Getting By, Living Between the Poverty Lines. It's focused on poverty, its causes, and effects. Coming up, a look at the Tucson initiative to end homelessness among veterans by the year 2015. And we'll examine the impact of recent state budget cuts on healthcare in rural parts of our state. Plus, hear a range of local reactions to the Supreme Court decision about same-sex marriage in California. And find out about the Public Library's third annual Manga Mania Convention, a celebration of Japanese art and culture. Those stories are all next here on Arizona Spotlight. First up, as part of our Getting By, Living Between the Poverty Lines series, we'll focus on the U.S. Census Bureau's calculation that Tucson is the sixth poorest large city in America. One of the contributing factors is homelessness, and veterans are far more likely to be homeless than other Americans. While vets make up less than 8% of the population, the federal government estimates that they constitute 16% of all homeless adults. As Andrea Kelly reports, the city of Tucson has set a goal to end veterans' homelessness by 2015. The mayor and others say that it won't be easy, but that it is a goal that is within reach.
Tucson Mayor Jonathan Rothschild has been working on the issue of veterans' homelessness. He met with federal agencies in Washington, D.C. earlier this year and then decided to accept a challenge from the federal government.
President Obama has made ending veteran homelessness a goal of his administration, and Tucson has been selected as one of 25 cities to lead the way in this effort. And I, on behalf of the city of Tucson and our community, am happy to accept this challenge from Washington.
Rothschild says Tucson has what it takes, including nonprofit agencies, military bases, a VA hospital, and respect for veterans. Unfortunately, Tucson also has veterans in need.
We have in Tucson, both at the University of Arizona and Pima Community College, veteran centers that serve student veterans. And I can tell you, we have veterans who are students who are living in their cars, and it's part of the population we have to reach.
Here's the path Rothschild and others see for getting veterans into housing. First, Sarah Tawil with Kodak Behavioral Health Services says the vets who aren't in homes need to be identified.
We're going to be outreaching throughout Tucson, Pima County, to truly identify and know every veteran in our community who's experiencing homelessness.
Then, she says, the organization will help get them into programs such as 51 Homes, which starts with housing and then moves on to other services a veteran may need, including health care or help finding a job. Here's the scale of the goal.
In order to do this, we're looking to assist 52 veterans a month into housing.
But there's a method to that number.
We also need to reorganize our existing resources so that our most vulnerable community members are prioritized. So our most vulnerable community members are folks who are experiencing chronic homelessness. This is long-term homelessness with a disabling condition. These are the folks that are at the highest risk for early mortality on the streets. And they also are high utilizers of costly community resources, emergency medical care, interaction with law enforcement. So we need to move these folks to the top of our list.
Jody Frederick of the VA hospital says this is an achievable goal. After those chronic homeless are housed, the focus shifts to other vets who qualify for federal housing vouchers. Richard White, Southern Arizona's Red Cross director, says the organization goes beyond housing people whose homes have caught fire and providing blood for transfusions. He says the Red Cross of Southern Arizona tries to hire veterans and has housed 160 in the last 7 months who were homeless or facing homelessness.
We're helping veterans get jobs. We want veterans to be able to have a steady stream of income so that they can sustain living in the housing that we're arranging for them.
The Tucson effort is not just for nonprofit agencies. Joe Gulotta, an assistant chief of the Tucson Fire Department, says fire and police frequently respond to calls that end up being about a homeless person who needs help.
But we're limited as to what we can do. Jail and a hospital may not be where these folks need to go.
Gulotta says police and fire departments carry referral cards to send people to appropriate services. But he says programs to end homelessness will help reduce the number of times that's necessary. Rothschild says there's also ways individuals can help.
We can put veterans into homes, but they need beds, chairs, dishes, cleaning supplies.
Davis-Monthan Air Force Base donates furniture for housing, and the DM50, a support organization for vets and the Air Force Base in Tucson, plans to work on the goal of making a home beyond just putting a roof over someone's head. Teresa Ramsey has been there. She served and then struggled.
In September 2010, things weren't right in my life, and I went to the VA and they gave me all the help I needed. They got me started in this homeless program in September 2010. I was in Old Pueblo for about a year. They helped me out quite a bit and also went to COPE a couple times to get some services there.
She says she would not have even been able to admit that she'd been homeless without the help she got from these local resources.
I cannot tell you how grateful I truly am to have been part of this program, and I'm really looking forward, Mayor, to this moving forward and bringing all these homeless veterans in. And I know that the help is there, and I pray that they reach out for it.
One struggle is measuring the success of these programs. Rothschild says a recent count of homeless people showed there were 353 veterans homeless in Tucson. But the city has been told to prepare to provide housing for more than 1,200 people in the next 3 years, because some will need help more than once. Davis-Monthan is expecting increasing numbers of military separations as the troop drawdown in Afghanistan continues. Rothschild says on top of reducing the number of homeless veterans as much as possible, the goal is to prevent others from getting there.
Part of what this goal is to do is to increase the infrastructure for all the homeless of the community. When we support Primavera, the Salvation Army, Red Cross, Kodak, COPE, there are going to be others in the homeless community that are going to be supported.
He says getting veterans into homes is the first step towards solving chronic homelessness. That includes children and families by the year 2020. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Andrea Kelly.
Another factor that's contributing to our state's poverty rate is the high cost of health care. Health care expenses are one of the top causes of bankruptcy nationwide. Coupled with cuts to programs that are designed to help the poor, the result is a recipe for financial disaster, especially in rural areas. Christopher Conover reports.
Living outside of a city has certain advantages. You're away from the hustle, there are wide open spaces. But those same positives can be negatives, especially when it comes to health care. In mostly rural Cochise County, the Copper Queen Community Hospital in Bisbee is increasingly drawing patients from all over, according to CEO Jim Dixon, because fewer and fewer doctors are serving rural areas.
What we're seeing is that people no longer use their primary care doctors as the gatekeeper into the healthcare system. They come back to the emergency room because there's nothing else available. And so that becomes an integral part of the delivery system.
The lack of care in rural areas is not limited to just primary care doctors. Specialists are even more difficult to find. For Copper Queen Hospital, that has meant an increase in telemedicine, connecting patients in Bisbee with specialists in Tucson and the Phoenix metro area. But telemedicine facilities are expensive to set up, and as the economy slowed, Dixon says available dollars for rural medicine began to dry up.
A lot of the subsidies that were recognized in the 90s and the 80s are now being taken away in the budget cuts, and that's what keeps it there.
Hospitals in rural areas often receive a large portion of their operating budgets from Medicaid, in Arizona, the program known as Access. But cuts to that program in recent years are adding to the economic problems for rural doctors and their patients.
As the recession hit, it affected rural areas a lot stronger than it did urban areas. And, you know, you don't have jobs being recreated out here and the economy coming back the way you do in urban areas. So it's basically what your mix is. And then you get geographically lucky. We are in a better area for a diversified payer mix, so we can do some of that.
Last month, state lawmakers passed a budget that included the restoration of funding cut from Access. Conservative Republicans balked at the increased funding, a stance that put them squarely at odds with Governor Jan Brewer. In the end, she won that political fight within her own party. The official state-run Access website even put video testimonials online of patients praising the proposed restoration of funding.
I am 59 years old. I am single and live alone. I've always worked to support myself. The job I have now doesn't provide health benefits and didn't pay enough for me to buy them. Recently, I felt dizzy and lightheaded and like I was going to pass out, so I went to St. Joseph's emergency room.
The increased Access funding won't kick in until January, and a group led by former Southern Arizona State Senator Frank Antonori is trying to get a ballot question in front of voters repealing the increased funding. In the meantime, Copper Queen Hospital's Jim Dixon says he worries that more and more rural medical facilities will close.
It'll happen one at a time. From what I hear from my peer group, it's getting harder and harder. We can't buy the equipment to replace. We can't keep state of the art. And that will affect access to care and disease management.
Over the last 2 years, Dixon says Copper Queen has seen a 40% increase in charity care. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Christopher Conover.
Our week-long series, Getting By, Living Between the Poverty Lines, will conclude tonight on Arizona Week, when Michael Chihok hosts a look at poverty's rise in the suburbs. That program begins at 8:30 on PBS6. More information and all of the stories in the Getting By series can be found online at azpm.org. More than 50% of all marriages in the United States end in divorce, and a sizable segment of our population is making the decision to postpone or even forego marriage altogether. However, for some Arizona residents, just being able to enter into a legally recognized union is an amazing development, and one that many had thought they might never see. Tony Paniagua explains.
Christiana Haida has a master's degree in marriage, family, and child counseling, and she's very familiar with the statistics about divorce. But Haida is ecstatic about being able to marry her partner of more than 20 years.
Nobody wants special rights. We just want to have the same rights anybody else does.
Haida is in a same-sex relationship in Tucson, and she recently traveled to California with her partner to tie the knot, thanks to a couple of recent rulings from the U.S. Supreme Court. The court made it possible for same-sex marriages to resume in our neighboring state, and it also ruled that same-sex married couples are entitled to federal benefits enjoyed by opposite-gender couples. And even though Arizona and the majority of other states do not recognize same-sex marriages, Haida is undeterred.
We're hoping that not only will it allow us some federal benefits, even though we live in Arizona, but we see the whole movement going towards equality, so we think within a few years we will have full rights even in this state.
Brad Sensenbach is a real estate broker in Tucson. He remembers the moment when he heard about the Supreme Court rulings.
We were kind of stunned at first. We weren't sure, was it going to stand? Was this real? You know, it just seemed like it was a little bit of dream come true.
Sensenbach has been with his partner, Sebastian, for more than a decade. Sebastian was born in Mexico and has a visa that permits him to work legally in the U.S. But if he can get his so-called green card, allowing him to become a permanent resident, his opportunities will increase. Sensenbach explains.
He is here now on a TN worker visa, which is quite cumbersome. He has a job he likes now, but he needs to work only that job. He can't work any part-time work. If anything were to go sour at his job, he'd have to go apply for a whole new visa. So when this came down and it looked like we could become a married couple and then I could sponsor him as my spouse, that opened up the door for us to be able to get a green card.
There are many reasons why people are choosing to get legally married, but not everyone with this opportunity is signing up.
I don't need the approval of the state to feel married.
Colette Barajas is a longtime activist and realtor in Tucson. She says she's glad other couples can enter into this legal relationship, but it's not something she finds personally necessary right now.
Kristen and I will be celebrating 10 years, and we believe that our God, our church, and our family and friends support our relationship, and that's good enough for us in considering that we live in Arizona and we can't receive any of the benefits. But our relationship is solid and acknowledged and supported by the people that it's important for us. We don't need a piece of paper.
And all of these different attitudes and circumstances are reigniting the conversation about the meaning of marriage in our society and government's role in regulating this institution. Fenton Johnson is an associate professor of English at the University of Arizona. He's also a novelist, essayist, and commentator.
If we took marriage out of the hands of the state, we would effectively separate church and state, which is one of the guiding principles of this country.
Instead of having to get married to qualify for benefits, Fenton believes people should have the option of passing them along to a person of their choice, such as a grandchild or nephew. What if someone is single, for example?
The government's job, the state's job, is to allocate rights to each individual equal before the law. And I'll give you an example. I contribute 50% of my Social Security income to my Social Security account. Why should I have to marry someone in order to leave that 50%, not the government's contribution, but that 50% to the person of my choice? This is an issue in which the government is still allocating benefits rights unequally.
Johnson wrote an article for Harper's Magazine almost two decades ago when the topic of equal marriage rights entered the national conscience in a very big way.
The speed with which this has happened is astonishing and enormously gratifying, and I really congratulate the people who fought for it. I, in my way, fought for it with that article, which ran coincident with the 1996 presidential election, in which same-gender marriage was, for the first time nationally, a very hot issue.
And with the recent emphasis on marriage, Johnson believes gays and lesbians may not have been paying sufficient attention to other important matters.
Most notably for me, the issue of employment protections. To give a good example, Arizona, a lesbian in Yuma who leaves her partner's photograph on her desk and refers to her partner as her partner can be fired from her job.
The sentiments about discrimination and equality are shared by many people in our community, whether single, legally married, or not. Again, Colette Barajas.
Because I believe in, as long as there are laws on the book that discriminate, then we all suffer.
Colette Barajas, Christiana Heide, Fenton Johnson, and others say there are plenty of issues that need attention. And while the recent Supreme Court rulings are a welcome victory, activists say they won't be resting on their laurels. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Tony Paniagua.
In Japan, comic books are taken more seriously as both an art form and as popular entertainment. The proof lies in the huge number of titles that can be found at any Japanese newsstand or grocery store. Besides superheroes and giant robots, there are long-running manga series that center around everything from soap operas to history to cooking, business, and sports. It's an industry that's valued in the billions, and that popularity has already spread to many other parts of the world. Here at home, the Pima County Public Library has been offering manga collections to readers of all ages for more than a decade. The dedication that some fans show for their favorite titles inspired electronic resources librarian Jennifer Caldwell to organize an annual Manga Mania convention. It's a chance for local fans to come together, share their enthusiasm, and also learn more about Japanese art and culture. I asked Jennifer Caldwell and teen librarian James Walter to tell us what it's all about.
You could see it over the past few years, just growing from a small section of the comic book library. It used to be a lot of, you know, Batman, Superman, Avengers, which is still really popular because the movies are still popular. But the manga has just increased. And as the popular series like Naruto, Bleach, One Piece, they're into their 70th, 80th volumes. You know, a lot of shelf space is dedicated to these things.
A lot of people these days may be impressed to know that teen readers are sticking with something through over 50 volumes of material. Mm-hmm. What kind of dedication do you see out of some of your most eager manga readers?
They are the ones that when the new one comes out, they're there on, they reserve the new volume when it comes out. I know some kids that'll read like the spoilers to the new chapters in Japan when they come out.
Jennifer, what do you think the readership is finding in these tales that is keeping them so hooked?
That's a great question. I think it's really the love of the story. And that's something that people don't often think about when they think about these types of books. Learning to love the characters, imagining yourself being part of the story. Fan fiction and fan art is a huge component of this. People really wanting to participate in the story in a way that I think we didn't see, you know, maybe 50 years ago. People really want to be involved in the characters' lives. They want to be involved in the story. And so that will keep them going through the 50, 60, 70, 80 volumes. And I think it's fantastic.
Well, most of our listeners are going to be able to identify with what James said about Western comic books like the Avengers, mm-hmm. where things center around a central heroic character. Mm-hmm. But that's not always the way it is with manga. Tell me about some of the genres that it crosses into.
Manga is more of an art form, so it will go into any genre you can think of. Any type of story that you love, there's a manga for it. If you like the giant swords, if you like action, if you like adventure, if you like romance, there's going to be something for you. And the great thing is that it really goes through all age groups as well. So there's manga for kids and for teens and for adults. And that, I think, is something that people really like about it, too. It's inclusive, and people really can find whatever they want to read, and they can discover new things, too, in an art form that they enjoy.
They've adapted a lot of Shakespeare works into manga. So kids that might not be interested in, you know, reading the old English-style Shakespeare could read this graphic novel and still get the story. Maybe it'll get them more interested in reading the real one. Ones that I try to push at the library, there's ones, manga books that'll teach you calculus, that'll teach you algebra. They do a story format around the math concepts, around the science concepts, so it's a little more engaging for the teens.
Well, people would say that that's been tried before in Western comics to not any great event, so how is it that manga is able to do it and keep the attention of the reader?
There's a lot of quirkiness in manga. At least the calculus one is a lot of slapstick. They'll throw some romance in there. So you get engaged with these characters they created basically to push the calculus. But then you get engaged with their story as well. I just thought it was a really fascinating thing.
How does Manga Mania explore this fascination that local kids are having with this form?
Well, actually, that passion, that excitement is where this whole idea got started, because we noticed at all of our libraries how much the teens loved the manga and how eager they were to check it out. And so we thought, you know, why not build on that excitement? So when we were thinking of what kind of summer programs we could do, that's what came to mind. When you love manga, when you love that type of story, you also love coming together with people who love the same things that you do. So it was just very natural to start to put together authors and drawing workshops and anime viewing. And before we knew it, we had a program that was a huge success.
At Manga Mania, my favorite part of it is the cosplay aspect. That's when people either show up to the event dressed up like their favorite character or create pieces of costume, create swords, create, you know, cloaks, create amulets at the event to show off their favorite characters. The teens are really supportive of each other. They'll help each other, you know, like, oh, that character's so cool, but, you know, you need more, like, red flair on that. And they'll really get into it. They'll really show each other, like, how to create the best costume. They'll give each other, you know, a standing ovation for a great costume. It's really good to see.
It seems like there's a dedication on the part of a lot of fans to learn more about Japanese culture. And it seems like this might partly be driven by the more you know about Japanese culture, the more you can understand and follow what's going on in the comics.
That's an excitement that we're really trying to build on. We have a lot of library programs that support that kind of love of learning at all ages, but especially for teens. For learning Japanese language, we're going to be featuring one of our online services, which is called Mango, where you can learn Japanese, and it's really a fun program, and it's completely free with your library card, so it's a great resource. We'll be featuring Freegle, which is an online service we have for music downloads. So you can download 3 songs a week for free with your library card, and you can learn about J-pop, you can learn about K-pop, any kind of music that you'd want, you can have for free. We're also bringing in this year something new. We're bringing in Japanese cultural groups to talk about Japanese language and what that looks like. We're going to be talking about Japanese food, cute food. Japanese love cute food, and I love it too. I mean, you can get eggs, hard-boiled eggs that look like newly hatched chicks. It's adorable. And so looking at these things is really the fun part of it. And you learn so much, and the more you learn, the more you love it.
J-pop is essentially Japanese pop. One of my coworkers is putting together a little handout J-pop CD to give. So in the back room of our library, we've heard a lot of like really frenetic, high-paced J-pop lately. And it'll be exciting to do these giveaways. It'll be exciting for everyone else to experience J-pop if you've never heard it before. They all have like really bizarre English names like Go Go Power with 4 exclamation marks and, you know, 2 stars behind it. It's really cool.
And the love of exclamation marks is why we do have 2 exclamation points in Mega Mania.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
That's keeping up the Japanese tradition.
So tell us where and when the event's going to be held this year.
This year we're partnering with Pima Community College downtown campus. That's going to be at 1255 North Stone, which is the corner of Speedway and Stone. It's going to be Saturday, July 27th from 2 to 6. And it's completely free. Just come on by and we'll get you in.
James, words of encouragement to young readers and teens who are being forced to listen to public radio right now by their parents.
There is plenty of great stuff to read at the library. No matter your interest, we can find a book for you. We're friendly people at the library. Just come talk to us. We'll help you out.
Well, share with our listeners one more synopsis. Give us an idea of a manga that you really like.
Well, I'm a librarian, so one of my favorites is Library Wars, which is set in a world where the government is trying to keep you from reading what you want. And so the librarians step up to battle on your behalf. And I just think that's so much fun because a lot of people don't realize that that's what librarians do every day. I mean, we fight to protect your right to privacy, and we fight to protect you against censorship, and we fight to protect your right to read. A lot of people don't realize that, but that is what we do, and that's why I love my job.
Sometimes art imitates life. The Pima County Public Library's Manga Mania Con is happening on Saturday, July 27th. There's information online at azpm.org. Thank you for listening to Arizona Spotlight. This show originates from the AZPM radio studios. The production engineer is Jim Blackwood. The music is by Calexico. I'm producer and host, Mark McLemore.